Well, I think the response speaks for itself, Dara. After last week's episode, we have had so much great feedback, and so many people listened to that episode with Yvonne Chouinard, and we're so lucky and so grateful to have such a wise old oak come and talk to us about all the things that he can lend his wisdom to. So from one giant in the world of business and fly fishing to another globe-trotting angler who has caught as many fish internationally as perhaps Yvonne has. Tell us a little bit about our next guest, Dara.
Well, Matt Harris, you have probably seen his pictures in fly fishing magazines. If you see his Instagram feed, he has the life of the globe-trotting fly angler, as you said, where he has been, I'd say, wherever you could throw a fly. He has not only caught the fish
if there's a fish there.
He has caught it. He also published and wrote Fish of a Lifetime recently. It's a lifetime's work that's gone into it.
It's an amazing thing. You do need a low loader to get it delivered because it is big. But there's a reason why it's so big. It's a sizable account of Matt's life as a fly fishing reporter. And it is stuffed with sumptuous, bright, beautiful, informative photographs and stories that accompany those photographs. Fish of a Lifetime, The Foal. It really is a book that you all need on your coffee table.
And I make no qualms about it. You speak to Matt Harris because it's fly fishing vicariously by talking to Matt Harris.
Yeah.
He will tell us about Alaska. He will tell us about Russia. He will tell us about South America. He will tell us about Iceland. He will tell us about New Zealand, Australia. And of course, the Atlantic salmon. And when you hear him talk with such passion about these stories and the place, you almost feel like you're there when he just describes catching the fish.
He's absolutely obligatory to have in any fishing hut out there. If you're lucky enough to be in a fishing hut with Matt Harris, he is the master of fishing stories. He is a raconteur with a rod. He will tell you anything and everything that you need to know and some about fly fishing. You just need to wind him up and he will go.
One time a group of us went to Jardines de Lorena in Cuba. And originally Jardines was a bonefish fishery because the guys, you know, there was no internet then. This is way back. Certainly no internet in Cuba. And they were basically learning the ropes themselves. And they were all effectively commercial lobster fishermen who'd been sort of, you know, turned into fly fishing guides. And they had to learn how to do it. And when we first went, Roxton's, you know, Christopher Robinson, who's not with us anymore, who's a great old stick who ran Roxton's, he went out there and they did a bit of test fishing. But nobody knew about tarpon. They didn't know how to catch them. They didn't know. So it was bonefish, and which is great. You know, ankle deep water, lots of bonefish, dumb as rocks. And then a famous guy called George Anderson, who's a brilliant fisherman from Montana, went out there and said, why? And Americans couldn't go to Cuba because of the whole deal. So he went out there and he said, why don't you fish for the tarpon? And the guide said, what tarpon? He said, come with me. And we went 2 weeks later and with our bonefish rods, and we'd taken tarpon rods just in case. And the guy said, don't bother with your bonefish rod. We're going tarpon fish. And we had the time of our lives. I can remember six skiffs, two guys in each skiff, guys and gals. Everybody hooked up to a big tarpon. So 12 people hooked up to them. Lines are crossing over, tarpon jumping everywhere. We came back and one guy said, what's your favorite fishing anywhere? And the first guy said, well, here. I mean, he said, I've never seen anything like it. You know, we'd all caught tarpon that were like north of 80 pounds each, I suppose. And when it got to me, I said, Atlantic salmon. This guy could not. He was a lovely guy. He's proper Cockney, which my granddad. And he said, you're joking. What's wrong with you? You know, he said, tarpon are bigger. You can see them. We're sitting out under the stars drinking mojitos. You know, we're not getting beaten by mosquitoes and wrapped up in, you know, thermal gear. It's sight fishing, you know, which is special. Sight fishing. I mean, one of the great things about salmon in Iceland. And you know, it was a very, he said, why would you, and he was quite animated. I mean, everyone had a drink or two. And he said, why would you want to fish for salmon? And he rattled off all these things. You know, it's blind fishing. It's dumb luck. They're not a fraction as big as the tarpon we've been catching, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I said to him, I can't put it into words. I cannot put it into words. But there is something about a big, fresh Atlantic salmon that no matter how often you try and quantify why they're so special, I mean, there's all the romance of them going off to sea, you know, coming back to the river they were born in. And, you know, and the more we learn about them, we realize they really do come back to the exact spot where they were born. But they're just so beautiful. And that grab, you know, which is often, and I don't want to see them actually. I love that blind fishing. And I love the fact you don't catch a lot of them. But you can tell, I mean, a lot of people said to me, you can tell when you read the book, even because I kind of declare my hand in the last chapter, which is about salmon conservation. But you can, someone said to me, a few people have said to me, you don't need to read that to know. That there's a chapter about a lovely river called the Varzina in Russia, and the Pasha. When I read it back, I really feel, and also the Yakanga, which is an amazing river in Russia, and I read it and I really feel it. And often, the classic thing is when you lose them, and the story about the Yakanga, which is one of my absolute favorite rivers, is about a fish I lost. Story about the Ricer at the end is about a fish I lost, and it is that. You know, but also I think increasingly, you know, the fact that they are so iconic, but they're also under so much pressure and in so much danger, makes them, you love them even more.
Get so nervous, or I do, when you get the thing in the net. I don't know about you, Dara, and you know, knowing how precious they are and how rare they are nowadays, it's like having a rare jewel in your hand. And there's almost, there I said, there's a little bit of guilt sometimes with me that trickles in, especially those few seconds where you think, is it going to come back? Is it going to come back? Do you know what I mean? And you're willing it to be okay.
For me, actually, I think it's, and it comes back to what you said as well, Matt. It's the journey to try and catch one. It's the difficulty of it. There's something, I don't know whether it's something about the human psyche, you know, it comes back to Buddhism. We live a life of 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows.
Yes.
And for me, there's something existential about the chase of salmon comparable to that. That I remember when I wrote my book, I'll plug my book, Haunted by Waters, about fly fishing. But the start of it is I'm standing in the Blackwater River, which is 30 minutes down the road from me here. And I wasn't catching salmon. I was casting for them, and I hadn't caught anything, and I just stood there. And you know when you're just standing in a river, there's just nature, there's nothing else around you, and I just stopped and looked around and said, this is, if I die and go to heaven, this is it for me.
Yeah.
And I remember my wife saying when I got home that day and told her, and she's like, so you're telling me heaven is half an hour down the road from you? Yeah. Why the hell aren't you there every day? Like, and I was like, I would if I could, but but it's for me, for me, Jimmy, like you were asking, for me, it's the journey, it's the difficulty, it's the climbing uphill to try and get there. And then finally you manage, you do it. I mean, like you said, when you hold it in your hands and then let it go.
It's poetry, isn't it? I mean, without trying to get pretentious, it's poetry. I mean, it's why the best poets, why Ted Hughes, you know, wrote reams of beautiful verse about, you know, these wonderful, wonderful creatures. It's they're magic. They're otherworldly, right?
Yeah, they are.
Tell us maybe some of your story from the book. Maybe give us a sample for the salmon stories from the book. I know you mentioned the Yakanga. Is there any particular favorites? Or
I'm looking at the Gaspé here as well. I need Canadian Atlantic salmon. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, they're all under a lot of pressure. I mean, wherever you go. The cola, I mean, we talk about salmon farms, which are a nightmare, an absolute, as we all know. But we talk about net, there's still a hell of a lot of netting, legal as well as illegal, in Norway, especially, where they still allow a lot of netting, which breaks my heart, you know, because they are, you know, the number of, there are now, if you talk to, another Whelan, if you talk to Ken Whelan,
yes,
he will tell you that there's between a quarter and a third of the number of salmon there were in 1980. You know, that is, I mean, that in that tiny, that, you know, in 1980, I was at school, you know, that's not so long ago from me.
One generation,
a long time ago. But it's a, you know, I just think that is a horrifying statistic. you know, for any animal to say that their numbers have gone down by maybe 75% in a generation, you know, that is just, it is. And we, because they're not cuddly, I know it's a well-worn, you know, we've talked about it often, but people don't care. They don't even know what they're eating. A lot of people that like eat salmon that they buy in the supermarket don't know it's from a farm. They don't know it's not a wild animal. They don't know about all of the drugs and the parasites and all the rest of it. There's no education. And they, yet they're such an amazing, such an iconic creature, you know, that go all that way and come all the way back. And they're so beautiful. And, you know, really to understand, you know, why we're so sort of in love with them, you have to see it, see one in, you know, a real live salmon with your own eyes to see that. You know that, and you can, like you say, Jim, you know, Ted Hughes, people have waxed lyrical about Atlantic salmon for many, many years, but nothing compares with actually seeing one. And, you know, I know what we were talking, I mean, I can remember in the early days when we used to go up and fish on the Kola Peninsula, you know, they're dangerous, those rivers. And, you know, there were a couple of terrible accidents up on those rivers that meant that health and safety rightly came in. But in the early days, you could fish for as long as you wanted on your own. And I can remember going down to a pool called Lilioc, which is a junction with the Lilioc stream, which is about 500 yards from the Yakanga Lodge. And exactly what you're talking about, Dara, that it was just such a magical time to be on your own, completely on your own. And I caught four fish, I remember, one night, through the night, because it's 24-hour daylight. And I kept thinking, oh, no, I got to go back now because, you know, tomorrow's another day. And it's already, we're already 4 hours into that day. And every time I thought, no, I was fishing a big sunray shadow and the fish would come up, you know, and it was like every time you start to reel up, they come and have a go and you'd fish another hour. And I can remember one fish in particular that I just about managed to land on my own. I had to cross the stream, which was tricky. And now it wouldn't be allowed on any of those rivers. You'd have to have a guide with you, you know, and all that stuff. But I landed that fish and it was 25-pound fish. So it was a good, not by the Yakanga standards, nothing out of the ordinary, but it was perfect. There wasn't a scale missing. You know, it had long-tailed sea lice on its back and it was a hen fish. I haven't got a picture of it. I was on my own. Camera was the other side of the stream. Yeah, that's Yakanga. I mean, they're a special fish. The you have to see that. But some people say, what's that? Because they don't realize it's an Atlantic salmon because their shoulders on those fish. Yeah, they're like no other fish. I've never seen Atlantic salmon anywhere else that look like those fish.
Brutes.
And yeah, they are. And they really, you know, hooking them is the easy part.
Yeah. Really. It's funny, isn't it? The shoulders. It's like, you know, when you know, we've all fished a bit, we've fished at different rivers and you know, there's always a slightly different shape to the salmon, depending on where you are. And the shoulders is always the thing, isn't it? They always talk about the shoulders and they're the best fighting fish because they're brutes. They're powerful up front.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, there's another river I love called the Reise in Norway, and the Reise is like a microcosm of the problems we have. So right now there's a guy called Carl Albert Hansen who drives up and down the northern Norwegian coast and he buys netted salmon and he says they're all legally netted and there's no one checking to know whether that's true. And he sells them. And he is making a fortune selling wild Atlantic salmon while the Reise River has no sport fishing allowed whatsoever until at least 2025. And if you read you'll find it in there, Dara. That river it's just over from the Alta. So the Alta, you know, the Alta is, I've fished the Alta
three
times.
The Holy Grail.
And it is the Grail. But, you know, I used to fish with a lovely old guy, Antti Parkkonen. But Antti was in his 80s and he didn't want to fish. He wanted to sit in the hut and eat and drink and remember the good old days, you know. And me and Pete Riffin, who ran Yakanga for a long time, Pete and I would be just champing it a bit to go fishing, but he would rather sit down. You can only fish from 8 in the evening till 4 in the morning, but he'd like to have a big lunch in the middle of that where you come back. You can imagine what it's like, and you can see the Alta out the window, and it was heartbreaking. We calculated how much it cost us a minute, and it was a few noughts on the end of it. It was just insane. But it is, you know, it is, you know, it is the Holy Grail for a reason. But the Ricer, which is just over the hill, it's about a 3-hour drive because it's a big hill. So you've got to drive around the hill and up a fjord and so on. The Ricer is effectively day ticket fishing. And it's, you know, big fish, not as many big fish as the Alta, but big fish. I mean, like 50-pound fish. But, you know, it's like association water. So you buy your ticket and you'd sit in the hut with 4 or 5 other people and then you take your turn through the pool. But I loved it. And I actually loved the camaraderie of the, you know, and also being smart, going out early and late, you know, and all that stuff, and picking spots that, you know, not the pools that everybody knew, but those little pockets where you might find a big fish. And it's shut to catch and release sport fishing while this clown is going up and down the river, up and down the coastline. And he's not allowed to buy fish from the Ricer's immediate fjord, but the fish come from Hammerfest, which is up to the north, all the way down that coastline. And so Hammerfest is like a rostering point. And there is no question that those fish, many of those fish are going to Ricer. So the Norwegian government are effectively sanctioning someone, you know, mass murdering or buying mass murdered fish, while the catch and release sport fishermen who look out for the river, who, you know, report any nefarious activities with nets or whatever, or snagging, or, you know, they're not on the river. So they're not protecting the river. So, but, you know, people always blame the politicians, but actually we get the politicians we deserve because we vote for them. You know, Norway is not some sort of totalitarian dictatorship. You know, people vote for them and they reflect what people in Norway want, which they want to eat wild salmon. And, you know, wild salmon's great to eat. But
do you wonder, Matt, though, is it like we covered Iceland on this podcast series and you see what the protests that are breaking out there? And you wonder maybe, you know, or is it hopeful thinking, but that, are we at a tipping point in terms of kind of public outrage at what's going on in terms of, you know, the plight of the world? I wish. Or is it just because Iceland is smaller? Like,
I think Iceland is a special case because, so what's happened, as far as I understand it, is that because of global warming, the waters around Scotland and now increasingly, you know, Ireland, Norway, even, are warming up.
So they're going
so north. Iceland, the sea around Iceland is colder. And warm water is not good for salmon, but it's particularly bad for farmed salmon. So you get more disease, you know, and they already have massive, and all these issues with the lice, you know, and close containment, that is nothing to do with our pressure, as far as I, this is my belief. It's to do with money, right? So the lice are killing so many fish. And if you watch
farm fish, this is you're saying
this is farm fish. Yeah, exactly. So what's happened is that the big companies like Maui have seen Iceland as a good alternative because the water's colder, right? And they've got a lot of fjords. If you look at a map of Iceland, and they've also got a lot of remote communities who haven't got any work. So if you think about that northwestern corner, that little peninsula, the Westfjords of Iceland, there are a lot of people there who can't make ends meet. You know, everyone thinks everyone's rich in Iceland. They're not. You know, there's a lot of money in Iceland sloshing around, but not everyone gets a big, you know, slice of that pie. So, you know, Maui and others have seen Iceland as a good place to set up. But the issue is that Iceland, probably more than any other country I can fish of, has a greater number of stakeholders who benefit and make their living from sport fishing.
It's a rural, so, it's much more rural, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it is. And, you know, the Iceland is surrounded. Every corner of Iceland seems to have a salmon river or a trout river, mainly salmon. So they're very invested in keeping that the way it is. And I know a lot of the old guard, Arni Baldason, he's a great, there's a lot of great characters from Iceland.
I love Arni. The salmon king, we call him, don't we?
Yeah. And Arni would catch, I don't care what anyone says, Arnie would catch a salmon out of a puddle. I mean, he's an absolute, he's dangerous. Great. And he really was dangerous for those rivers. So his mentor was a guy called Totti, who's known as the dentist. And Totti taught Arnie to fish, and they would literally empty a river with worms, not fly fishing, in the bad old days. He's just a great character, and he now is very invested, as a lot of his, you know, his colleagues, in looking after the fishing. You know, and Icelandic people recognize, I think, how valuable the salmon are to them, in a way that a lot of other communities, like, I mean, you know, if you go and talk to a Scottish gillie, of course they recognize, but a lot of people who live in, you know, downtown Glasgow or Edinburgh, they're not so invested in, they're remote from the plight of the Atlantic salmon.
Interestingly, I was at just last night, actually, I was at a Missing Salmon Alliance talk, and there was a guy there, Alan Wells, who heads up Fisheries Management Scotland, and he was talking about aquaculture. And what you were just saying, Matt, about, you know, they sort of prey, for want of a better word, on small, poor communities on the coast because it gives them employment. He's finding, with aquaculture, for the first time ever, literally in the last year, obviously they have to apply for licenses, you know, these aquaculture companies, as I call them. Mm-hmm. And it's like planning permission in a sort of crude way. They have to get votes to get it through from the local community that they're going to put the fish farm opposite or near. And he's finding for the first time ever, these local communities, as poor or as sort of underfunded as they are saying no, because they're now aware of the damage and, I guess, the stigma that comes with working for salmon farms, having them in the ocean opposite, you know, where you live. And for the first time ever, they're turning down licenses, the Scottish government, because of the locals, which I think is that's fabulous. Great. That's great. Yeah, it is. You know, that's progress.
It is. I mean, and I think that is part of, you know, I don't think we need to pat ourselves on the back too much because, you know, we are certainly not winning too many big victories against the salmon industry. But I think that by spreading the word, and there's so many people out there doing their bit, you know, and we've, you know, Jim, you and I know that there's often a divergence of opinion about how best to do this. And I've always, I should say, Dara, I've often been in spats, as Jim has, with other people who, you know, we're all on the same side. And I always, Jim's heard this analogy many times, but I always liken it to one of my favorite films, which is The Life of Brian and the Judean People's Popular Front. And the only people they hate more than the Romans are the People's Popular Front of Judea, you know. And actually, if we could all just, you know, and I do understand why some people are frustrated with, you know, people who are less aggressive in their tactics or more aggressive in their tactics, you know, because, but actually, I think we need the whole gamut. I think we need people providing the science, which is what the Atlantic Salmon Trust often are involved in funding that. You need that. You can't just say, oh, we think this, or you've got to say, we know this, and here's the evidence. But it is very divisive, and I think it's a shame, because I would really, you know, I know there's Corin who jumps in the cages and films the fish. We need that.
Absolutely. We need Corin Smith. Need
the scientific evidence, and then we need to get together and all make a noise and make people realize what they're eating. And I, you know, my dear old mum, who's 86, she often, she said, will you get me some salmon? And I just show her the pictures. And she said, no, I don't want to look. I don't want to look.
I know.
I said, well, that's what you want. You know, you want me to buy you that stuff. And she's so upset when I won't buy it.
I think back, Matt, to the smoking industry, tobacco industry.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, how yeah. It was just accepted. You know, yeah. And how slowly, generation after generation, year after year, it started changing. Now you look at the packets with the big warning signs.
Well, that's what should be on the salmon packet.
Yes.
It should be Corin's pictures. It doesn't have to be Corin, you know, Mikkel Frodin. Lots of people have jumped in those cages and taken those pictures. But I would really like to see those
government health warnings.
Yeah, with a picture of what you're eating, you know, because those salmon, they all look like that. I mean, when you see the film from the, you know, the pictures, you know, I've heard people, I've been in spats with people on social media who were paid up patsies for the salmon farming industry. And no, they don't all look like that. Well, watch this video, because they all do. You know, they've got eyes missing.
I mean, to be fair, and I mean, no, we're going to defend them. Obviously, you know where my vote lies, but there are varying degrees of quality, I think. And there are really piss poor, for want of a better expression, salmon farms. And there are better managed salmon farms. I'm not saying any of them tick any boxes when it comes to animal welfare, but I think, from what I've been reliably told, you know, the higher end versions of the, you know, battery, it's basically battery chicken farming, isn't it? But in the sea, they're not all, you know, covered in.
But if you look, Jim, if you look at what happened, I mean, this. So when I was in Iceland, so I was going to tell you more about Iceland, I'm afraid, Dara. So one of the things that was under the radar for many years is there's amazing sea trout fishing in Iceland. And what I love about it is it happens in autumn. So you get all the colors and the atmosphere, you know, and Iceland's pretty bleak in autumn, but I love that. I absolutely love it. And the rivers are gin clear. It's all spit. I'm not going to upset you anymore. But I was there at exactly the same time as the salmon will be spawning. So the sea trout spawn much later. So I was fishing for sea trout, basically in the estuaries and up into these little rivers. And they're still running, but the salmon are all well up and spawning. And there was a massive breakout from this Westfjord farm. Now, that farm, what Jim's saying is true, that you know, the farms, some are better than others, but you would think that with all of the pressure on the salmon farming industry, that Maui, who are one of the biggest players, one of their subsidiaries owned that farm, and the escapees from the farm got into so many different Icelandic rivers, and they will, and at the worst time possible, because the fish are spawning. And so they can muddy the gene pool. And once you start doing that, the fish get much weaker. They can't find their way home. You know, there's all of that stuff that muddying up the DNA of those wild fish will do. And this is right now. I mean, that happened 6-8 weeks ago. And this is something that, to me, demonstrates that the salmon farming industry have not cleaned up their act. You know, this is a brand new farm. I mean, the Icelandic farms are pretty new. And those escapees are every bit as bad. I mean, there's a lot of different facets as to why open cage salmon farming is bad for salmon. And that's one of them that often goes under the radar. People talk about the lice. You know, the huge impact it has on the smolts if the wild smolts are coming past the cages, but also escapees. There's been so many big escapes in Iceland, and that's gonna have a very, very harmful impact on their wild fish. And the answer is right there. The answer is closed containment, completely closed containment tanks, which is you can now eat salmon that were farmed in Miami, which is amazing. But, and people say, well, do I want to eat salmon? Well, those fish, they may not be the romantic notion of the cold North Atlantic, but those fish have not had to be packed full of drugs because of the sea lice issue. You know, the temperature's regulated and we have to eat stuff. You know, we can't get away from the fact that we do have to eat. And for about 12,000 years, we've been farming instead of foraging. So that's what we do. So we do have to eat. So we can't just say, oh, we don't want, you know, there's a lot of issues with chicken farming, with beef farming. There's lots of issues with a lot of animal food production. But we do have to tackle it in a way that means that we don't destroy our wild creatures, whether it's salmon or anything else.
There's a couple of things I think on that, Matt, is like, are you hopeful about the future of the wild salmon in terms of what can be done to address its plight and to address the problems surrounding it?
No, I'm not. I mean, I want to say yes. Of course we want to say yes. But no, I'm not. I think that protest, so 1% of the Icelandic population went to Reykjavik and protested. You know, that's quite something. I mean, that's a lot of people. And if you can galvanize people, you know, you look at what's happening with the Palestinian issue right now. That's a lot of people. And the governments have to respond. When they see those people, you know, they know, you know, I mean, Western governments have supported Israel. I'm not going to get into the politics of Gaza. But, you can see a direct response when, you know, 500,000 people march through London or New York about anything, the government have to sit up. And you can see the way the rhetoric on Palestine changed, you know, when that started happening. And that is something that, you know, on a small scale, I don't think you're getting 500,000 people marching to Westminster about wild salmon. But if you can galvanize people to make a noise and say, this is not, you know, we're not going to put up with this, then it does work. You know, people, the governments in you know, God forbid it ever changes, but certainly governments in Western Europe are democratically elected. And when they see, you know, that the sea change in opinion, and I think a lot of people learned about the whole Palestine issue. And when they see that and they see what's happening, they change, you know. So if we can galvanize enough people to say, you know, we don't want, because it's, and it isn't just the salmon. Salmon farming has a horrific effect on the environment, you know, on the local fjords. I mean, I wrote an article about it recently, and when you write, you educate yourself, because you can't write stuff that you can't justify. You know, you put your neck on the block. So I did some research on it, and you know, you realize that, so under an average salmon cage, there is the same amount of feces as is produced by Dunfermline, or I can't remember, three towns, and I knew one of them in Surrey, Redhill in Surrey. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of shit, excuse my French, under one. And then when you see those, I mean, if you drive along the North Norwegian coast, they're everywhere. And you think there's another Redhill or another Dunfermline with all that shit underneath it. And that is, and it really is bad news. I mean, it's very acidic, and you get this kind of dead zone under the, which again, Corin Smith and Michael Fredin and other people have shown, that under those nets is a complete dead zone. And that is, you know, and also another thing, and again, pictures are very powerful. Some of the images of the dead salmon in landfill, you know, they're powerful. When you see all those carcasses thrown into a pit, you know, you realize that's not good. That isn't good. That's a lot of fatalities. And if we're losing that many fish, then how good is it to eat what we didn't get?
Exactly. 25% mortality. It's just crazy, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. And on all those, I mean, there's been studies, University of Albany in New York, a guy, he basically said, don't eat Atlantic salmon. He said, if you're pregnant, don't eat it. If you're a kid, don't eat it. If you're not either of those two, you know, if you don't fit into either of those two demographics, have it twice a month, maximum.
Well, a friend of mine who's just come through cancer, through chemo, and the doctor said one thing you probably shouldn't eat when you're on chemo is Atlantic salmon.
Yeah,
isn't that, that's weak, wild, isn't it?
That's right. Insane. Yeah, and that, to me, that says, you know, you don't want to eat stuff that's not all right to eat. You don't want to eat it at all. You don't want to eat it,
especially when you think you're eating it because it's really healthy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
There's the dichotomy. Yeah. You know, people think, oh, I'll have some salmon. I'm going to have a healthy meal tonight. I'm going to have some salmon.
Well, wild salmon is very healthy. And one thing, I mean, one of the arguments that the aquaculture lobby employ is that if we didn't have farmed salmon, we'd be eating the wild salmon. And they may have a point. So you've got to outlaw that for sure. But, and I do think that when you look at people like Arctic Sapphire, who are the people with the closed containment tank in Florida, we should be fast tracking research to see, is that stuff all right? I guess it is, but maybe that's a bit naive on my part. But if that's all right to eat, I've never tasted it, but if it's all right to eat, then we should be investing money in making that happen. And it is more expensive. And so far, again, as far as the research that I've done has shown, is that the reason that the big players like Maui don't want to do it is that it's more expensive. So profit margins come down. But also, and I think this is one of the things that goes unsaid, if you can farm salmon in effectively a swimming pool, then you can build that swimming pool anywhere. You know, you don't have to be in Norway. You can be in Shanghai, you know, and suddenly that's a huge export market that right now they're predominantly owned by Norwegians, like Maui. So Maui would, you know, suddenly, you know, it only takes one of their research guys to say, I'm off to Shanghai for a big wedge of cash. And then suddenly the Chinese, who I'm guessing eat more Atlantic, you know, farmed Atlantic salmon than anyone, or the Americans or the Japanese or all of the big markets can make their own salmon, and Maori have lost control of the market. And I think that may well be holding back a close containment development.
So we're waiting for the next Elon Musk to come up with, yes, with the Tesla of farm salmon.
It could, that's exactly right. Yeah. You know, and it could be him. You know, it could, I mean, he's crazy. He really is a crazy genius.
He's crazy enough to succeed, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, he might, I'm not sure if he's listening, but he might, you know, that's the kind of thing. He's got the capital to make that happen.
Mm.
And salmon, actually, you know, wild salmon, I can honestly say I've never killed a salmon unless I've killed it by hooking it in the gills, or, you know, it's died on me. And that's only happened a handful of times. But I can remember one of the guides killing a salmon on the Varzuga, the first time I ever fished for salmon successfully with a fly rod, on the Varzuga River on the Kola Peninsula, which is 25 years ago. And I caught a nice fish, kind of an 8-pound fish, and the guy killed it. He didn't ask me, just bash. And we had it for lunch on the riverbank, and I've rarely tasted anything better than that. You know, it is fabulous to eat. But the Varzuga is probably you could probably count on one hand the rivers where it's sustainable to kill salmon and eat them. I mean, the Varzuga had a run of, I can't remember, like 500,000 fish. So Pinoy the same. But even the big fish rivers on the north coast of Russia, you know, their numbers are down, 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 like everywhere else.
Well, so, we can only assume that now, because we're not going to get a look in anytime soon, sadly.
Which is a shame.
So Matt, just on that note, sticking to the conservation of salmon, we ask our guests three questions on every podcast, and I'd love to ask you the first one, which is, if you were gifted €1 billion or £1 billion, whatever, a huge lump of money, and you had to spend it on the conservation of the Atlantic salmon, how would you spend it?
Well, do you know, I think it's a great question, because it's always easy to get angry, isn't it? It's easy to go, oh, you know, but be constructive. So I think the first thing is, as I said earlier, that people have to remember that we've got to eat something, right? That we can't just say, oh, we're not going to, you know, we're going to shut this down and shut that down. I mean, a lot of other animal welfare in the farming industry is very bad. And we eat a lot of bad stuff, whether it's chickens or beef or whatever. So salmon are not unique in being, you know, in being farmed in what I think is an unethical and unsustainable way. So if I had that, we've just answered that question in a way, because if I don't know how many billion dollars Elon Musk has got, but those people are exactly the people that could save the Atlantic salmon. And, you know, if you go to the Alta, they say, and this is one of the crying shames of the salmon dilemma, is that when you go to the Alta, and you have to be, unless you are very lucky, as I was, I met the guy, Sasha Savage. He's a great guy. And his partner, who used to fish the Alta with him, was killed in a skiing accident. And Sasha invited me to fish the Alta. So I got lucky, right? But most of the people on the Alta are blue bloods. You know, they are kings. I mean, I've gone past a guy and been told to wave at him because he was the king of Norway and he was happy fishing away, you know. And there's the Duke of Westminster over there, and there's the Duke of, you know, everybody apart from me seem to be royalty or semi-royalty or a very wealthy hedge fund guy or so on, right? So salmon fishing does attract, you know, it's kind of the sport of kings. And it's, apart from a few of us, you know, who get it done one way or another, most people who salmon fish are wealthy and they're influential. It's not just the fact they've got a lot of cash. They know, you know, the right people. They've got leverage. And so I do think that we have got the potential. I mean, if I had $1 billion, I would invest it in two things. I would invest it in the close containment salmon farming, I'd make another $1 billion because I think that if you could fight a twin pronged attack where you rightly exposed open cage farming, because it's not, you know, we are not, I think there's a lot of good people from the Atlantic Salmon Trust to Wildfish to Patagonia, you know, there's a lot of people making a noise, but we're not getting the cut through we need, you know. And occasionally, like Fergal Sharkey's done amazing things with, you know, he's got cut through. Fergal's done great. And, you know, who'd have thought that this scruffy sort of, you know, pseudo punk rocker from my childhood. I mean, if you said to me 20 years ago, see that guy, he's going to be a firebrand for clean water in the UK. I mean, you know, but good on him. And Fergal has shown that you can get cut through. And when you get that, you get results, you know, and things are happening. And that's what you need. Sorry, Dara, that's what you need to happen. So if you've got $1 billion, I would invest it in I would invest it in close containment tanks. I would spread it. I would incentivize nation states to use it, which would cut the throat of Maui.
Yeah.
Because Maui are only Maui because they are exporting what they make. And there's how many people in Norway? Not many. And if you suddenly took that away from them by providing close containment salmon, and it is a big if, but if you can do it in a sustainable way, an affordable way, which I think you can, because Arctic Sapphire are showing it can be done, then you would cut the demand for farmed salmon. The next thing I would do, if I've got any money left, I would lobby the Norwegian government hard. They've designated the Atlantic salmon as an endangered species, but allow people to kill them and sell them. That to me is, that can't be right. But they do it because the Norwegian people vote for them, you know, and they will make themselves unpopular. They are democratically elected.
I really like the analysis that you were saying there, Matt, in terms of going after it by going down the alternative route. And I actually think the real cut through, that's, I think, where the real cut through will come. I mentioned Tesla earlier. Maybe the actual, and this is, you know, shows you where we are in terms of the 21st century and the future, but maybe the answer is Silicon Valley. And it's actually a technological solution to a nature problem or a nature issue, which is, of course, is caused by mankind. So I think actually if you had that billion, that's the way to go, is if you can get the Silicon Valley guys on board and you show them the value of the salmon farming aquaculture global industry and say, do you want to disrupt this industry and create a real alternative, again, like the Tesla, that people actually want?
That's a great analogy. I mean, look, if you'd have said, you know, that Tesla, if I'd have drawn you a little pen portrait of the Tesla model 15 years ago, it'd be hard to believe it, wouldn't it? You know, and now Tesla's the biggest selling car. So who told me? Mark, who's the boss man at Atlantic Salmon Trust, he told me that Tesla's the best selling car in Europe, right?
And
that's amazing. It's not cheap. That's not a cheap car.
But can I ask you, Matt, then, this follow up to the $1 billion question is, if you had no money, so anybody listening to this in terms of what can they actually do or what should they be doing?
Spreading the word, you know, especially in the era that we're in, social media, you know, social media costs nothing. So I advertise my book successfully on social media, and Instagram don't like you doing it. You know, they know, and they it pops up. And so my posts where I'm actively selling my book get a tiny amount of traction compared with if I just put me gurning with a big fish, you know? But they get enough, and I sell books, and it costs me nothing. I can make 20 posts in an afternoon if I want, and I can, you know, I can write about, I can say what I want, pretty much. I can then create. Again, if what I say is articulate and captures people's imaginations, that costs nothing, but they will then spread it in a viral way. And you look at Pete Tijas, he's a great guy. Pete is a lovely man, and he's a West Ham fan like me for his sins. Pete Tijas had this leafleting campaign, and he would go into the supermarkets. And he put a leaflet that said, do you know what you're eating? In as many words. And he just drop it where the farmed salmon were on sale. Now, he couldn't do every Tesco's or every supermarket in the UK, but he could let a lot of people see what he was doing. And then it spread, and people think, what a great idea. And then they do, and then their friends do it, and it spreads. And not, even if they don't do it, they see it, and they, and that the great beauty of the social media network is that if you see something that you agree with, you can share it.
Mm.
Whether it's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you can share it and share it and share it. And my dear old mum, who still wants that salmon. I mean, I can remember farmed salmon until I knew how bad it was. I loved it. I won't pretend I didn't. You know, it's tasty and it's supposed to be good for you. She still wants to eat it. But I show her Pete Tigess's, you know, leaflet, and I show her Corin Smith's photographs, and I read her stuff from the Atlantic Salmon Trust. She still wants to eat it, but she's less kind of aggressive about pushing for it, because she knows. And the thing is that, as I say, that costs, okay, you've got to be able to afford the access to the network. And we live in a very dark time right now, where not everybody does have that access, but enough people do that you can spread that word without any cost. So if I make a post that says, so one of the things I talked to Jim about was having some sort of march. When I saw what happened in Iceland, it really inspired me. And I know those people. Vala, we talked about Arnie. So Vala's Arnie's daughter, and she's a lovely woman. She's part of that generation of Icelandics. They've got a lovely way about them. They're confident, and they will not take shit from people. And they're all there, you know, and they took those dead carcasses and dumped them in the middle of Reykjavik and said, we are not standing for this. And I would like to see the Brits, you know, and not just the salmon fishermen and the gillies and the boatmen and the, but I would like to see everybody who feels that, because it's part of a bigger picture. The state of our water in the UK is a scandal. It is every bit as big a scandal as the salmon scandal, I think. You know, and that would bring a lot more people in who can talk to each other. So the surfers, the kayakers, the fishermen, you know, and you're going to get some antipathy. You know, not everyone thinks fishing is the right thing to do. And Jim said it. I feel the same. I sometimes think, what am I doing? But they're fish. They're not people. And we love those fish more than all the people who complain about fishing, who have never seen a fish, you know, who sit on their couches and their sofas, you know, saying the easy things, regurgitating all the easy noises. Fishing, I know, is good for me, and I think it's good for both of you, and I think it's good for most of the people who go fishing. It's not just good for us, yeah, and it is an irony, but it's definitely good for the fish,
yeah,
which is such an irony, but it's good for the fish. We may drag them kicking and screaming out of the water and put them back again, but we fight for their water quality. We fight, you know, and no one's out there fighting for fish apart from fishermen. I can't think of anyone.
No, you're right. And on that note, bringing it back to fishing, we also ask our guests if it was your last day on Earth, Matt. And, you know, hypothetically speaking, the rivers were healthy. There was an abundance of cold, clean water, and there were salmon running pretty much everywhere. Where would you pick to go fish, and who would you take with you?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. The simple answer, the Yakanga in Russia, I love with a passion. I love that river. I may never fish it again. But I've had so many thrills and spills on that river. And when I wrote my book, Dara, I actually chose to write about losing a fish, because losing a fish is more special in a lot of ways. And I lost a fish on my own after an hour and a half. And I think it was the biggest fish. I mean, I actually lost two big fish over about a 36-hour period. And the first one, I mean, again, this was in the good old days when you could go fishing any time of day or night. We were on the lower river, which had only recently opened up because it used to be a military zone in Russia. And I chased a fish on my own for an hour and a half, and I lost it right at the end when I could see it. It was beaten. It was upside down, its belly showing, and I lost it. And I remember thinking, I was completely on my own. It was 2 a.m. and I thought, I could have a cry now. You know, there's no one here. And I was like a broken man. I wanted that fish so badly. But I didn't. But I always remember the punchline to that story, which is hopefully subtle, is that I trudged a mile and a half back upstream, and there's my kit, and it's 2 a.m. And you know what I did? I started fishing again. You know, I mean, that's the Akanga. It's a special river. But actually, if this is a complete fantasy, I would love to go to the Upper Thames, which used to have millions of salmon running up it, with all my pals and a bunch, you know, and plenty of good scotch and a few beers and God knows what else, and have a day with all the, you know, I mean, this is going to sound a cliche, and it is a cliche, but the best thing that's happened to me with fishing is the people I've met. And that is the God's honest truth. I've met people from all over the world. Craig Simpson, who was my guy, if you read the chapter about New Zealand, which is one of my favorites, there's some, you know, writing, sometimes it just pours out. Sometimes it's hard, you know, and you have to work at it. You know, Dara, sometimes it's like homework, you know, and you remember your school days and you, no, that's not right. And you tear it up and stuff. But I can remember fishing in New Zealand with a guy called Craig Simpson, who's one of the loveliest guys you'd ever meet. And he died this year. And he was only, Craig must have been in his mid-60s, and he was tough as, you know, when we used to go wading in New Zealand, I would have Gore-Tex, you know, neoprene, thermal this, thermal that. Craig would be in shorts with his pink, I think he was of Irish extraction, I guess. He looked like, he is a lovely man. He could talk the hind legs off a donkey. We used to sit in the pub, and it's at, read that chapter, and he used to have this phrase. He'd always say, I'd say, where are we going tomorrow, Craig? And so I'm going to take you to the Nunya River. And I don't know if you know, that's a famous old gag in New Zealand, and it's spread as in none your fucking business, excuse my French. And we met a mate of mine, Andrew Donaldson, who's a Kiwi. So I wrote that story, and it was in Trout and Salmon. And I caught, in within 2 hours of each other, I caught a 12-pound brown trout and an 11.5-pound brown trout, and they're in a river, right?
Wow.
And they are the most magnificent fish. I mean, those fish in Iceland are great, but it's a lake.
Yeah, yeah.
To catch a fish that size in a river with a 5-weight rod, you know, and a tiny little fly, and to see them, that is some of the best fishing there is.
You really capture that loss that you were just talking about just then on the Ikanga. Can I just read out the embers of that battle, because it's definitely worth a read. The rod tip wrenched down to the horizon, and for a brief instant, I felt the full weight of the great fish as it was momentarily arrested on its violent, careering journey downriver. Then, in a wretched, sickening, heartbreaking second, all that wild, angry silver violence was gone. I wound back the long, long yards of backing in that awful, gutless trance that only those who have lost a huge fish will know. The leader was hopelessly frayed and had parted a foot above the fly. I sank to my knees. A huge wave of bitter disappointment broke over me, rushing in to fill the vacuum left by all that desperate, wild-eyed exhilaration of the last 90 minutes. I sat there for a long time. It's great.
Brilliant.
It's great, isn't it?
I remember that. Absolutely. I mean, it's lovely. Do you know the thing that I really like, Jim, and thank you for that?
But that's beautiful.
That I really loved is, you know, I'm a professional photographer, right? That's been my business so I've worked for ad agencies all around the world. I've won gongs from the Association of Photographers, and I'm blowing my own trumpet, which I didn't mean to do.
Blow
but
away,
that's
mate.
That's my job, right? That's my job.
Yeah.
But the writing is from, I'm not a professional writer. You know, I've written for Trout and Salmon and Fly Fisherman and Magazine and this magazine, but I didn't train as a writer. You know, to become a professional photographer, I worked for some brilliant photographers. Some of them were difficult, but they were all brilliant for about 4 years. I did a 3-year degree course. I trained to do that.
Mm.
But the writing is from the heart. It is from the heart.
Write what you feel.
You learn some formulas with writing. You learn not to repeat the old cliches about bars of silver and all that stuff, you know, that stuff. But there are sometimes, as I was saying earlier, there's sometimes, and that story is from my heart. And I know that might sound a bit cliche, but I remember when you read that out, I remember I can see it. I can see it. And it takes me back there. And I think that when I'm an old man already, but when I'm a very old man, I'll remember it. And I like having written it down, because it takes me there, you know, in a way that the memory will start to fade, you know, and it will be a touchstone that you can read that And I hope other people can empathize, because I know a lot of people. I lost a fish on the Risa River. I don't lose all of them. I've got some good fish, but I remember a fish on the Risa, and I played that fish for a long time, probably 90 minutes the same. And it wasn't done, but I just so wanted someone to see that fish. And these two Finnish guys came out of the woods. It's in the last chapter, which is called The River of Ghosts, which is about the Risa. And if you extrapolate about the fear that I have, you know, that my grandchildren, you know, God forbid, won't see these things, won't see Atlantic salmon. But these two Finnish guys came out, and I remember, because I've been trying to call people on a mobile phone and play a fish is not easy. But I've been trying to call all these different people to come and help me. And I remember thinking this, and that was long after the fish you just read about. And that was actually, I think, would have been the fish of my lifetime. And I saw it, and I honestly couldn't believe how big it was. I just couldn't believe it. And I thought, I'm attached to that. And I've done the hard part. And these two Finnish guys came up, and they were disappointed because I'd gotten the spot. And as I said, with the Risa, it's sort of public fishing. So it's not, you've got to buy a ticket, but, you know, and I saw their shoulders slump, you know, and then they came up, and then one of them realized I was playing a fish as he got nearer. And he said, "Is it a big fish?" And I said to him, and I never put that in the book. I said, "It's the fish of my life." And and they both looked at me, and only one of them could speak English. The other one had a bit of English, but one guy could speak good English. And the fish came up the pool, and it did a, and it was a stale fish. It wasn't a silver fish. It did a proper cartwheel, like a proper flip. And these two Finnish guys just went mad. They went, there's a thing that Scandies do. I think it's a Finnish thing particularly. They go like this. They go, oi, 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 oi. And they both did it. It was like synchronized. And one of them started yabbering. And I said, what's he saying? And he says, he thinks it's more than 20 kilos.
Bloody hell.
And that's a big fit. So 20 kilos, 44 pounds. And I said, yeah, I reckon. And he said, I don't think it is. And I said, really? He said, that fish is more than 25 kilos.
Now, wow.
That is a very big sound.
The 50 plus.
Now it's 55 pounds.
Wow.
So I know from guiding people, and especially, you know, up in Scandinavia where people talk in kilos, 2.2 pounds is a kilo.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Now, we didn't weigh it. It may not have been anywhere near that big, but it's certainly, I've caught some big salmon. I've caught salmon up to just under 40 pounds. And this thing was in a different league to that, any of those.
Well, at least you were connected to it. At least you had it for a little bit. Yeah.
When I lost it, it jumped about, I mean, starfish don't often jump, but this really jumped. And it was a big, you know, it was a deep fish.
Yeah.
Because starfish often go, you know, they go deep because they kind of get a bit flaccid. So they look deeper than they do when they're fresh. Because they're fresh, they're kind of packed, the muscles tight. And then on the umpteenth jump, it spat the hook out. And it went in a tree behind. It was on a short line. I was trying to get into a bay. So I've got a great mate, Alan Code, an Irish fella. He taught me that if you can get a fish into slack water, there's no oxygen. And it's like banging them on the head with a hammer. And if you can do that, you'll land the fish really quickly. And that's changed. I mean, I land a lot more fish than I used to. Alan's a mentor to me. He's a great salmon fisherman.
That's good advice.
Fish the shore. Advice. You probably know the shore.
It's my local river.
There you go. So Alan Cody, he's a lovely guy. Absolute gem of a man. So anyway, I was trying to get it into this slack and it didn't want to come. And then it just did this, and it jumped the wrong way. It always jumped upstream, then it jumped downstream. So it turned the hook point round, and the hook came out, and it went up in a tree behind me. And same thing as what you just read out. You know, it's probably, I mean, clearly this is what I do when I lose a fish. I just sank to my knees. I just sank to my knees, and I was like John Cleese. You know, John Cleese used to do that thing. And I was just groaning, and these two Finnish guys I'd never met before started patting me quite. You know, you could tell they were like, this is a bit weird.
It's like you've just been given some really, really bad news.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So this book is like your journal, really, isn't it? That, and what were you saying a few minutes ago? How lucky that you've got this and you can refer back to this as a wonderful diary, as a journal. And that sort of spurred me on. Just humor me here, Dara. It's kind of like, this is your life for Matt Harris, isn't it? With Eamon Andrews, Dara, will you wrap us up by saying, Matt Harris, this is your life in your beautiful Irish accent?
Matt Harris, it's been an absolute pleasure. I want to go to Iceland fishing with you. Please bring me on your next trip. This has been the fish of a lifetime, the story of a lifetime. This has been your life.
Good on you. Thank you, Darren. Thanks, Jim. Darren, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Coming up in the next episode of The Last Salmon,
we have the co-author of The New Fish, a wonderful book, a new book about the truth about farmed salmon and the consequences we can no longer ignore. We are talking to none other than Simen Setra.
If you want to know about the history and development of fish farming, from its early days in Norway to becoming a multi-billion dollar industry across the world, if you want to know about its dirty practices, if you want to know about its questionable ethics, if you want to know about the opposition, if you want to know about how science and politicians and governments have tried to acquiesce and appease fish farming down through the decades and generations. But if you also want to know about what people are trying to do to fight it, about the health consequences, about what people can do and how hard it has been to try and fight this industry, you have to listen to this interview.
Most people didn't care or didn't have any information. So you had, you know, on one side, the people working in the industry and a few dedicated people, a few activists opposing them. I think what happens now the last years is that more people, we also see that more researchers and scientists speak out against the business. Normal people, people who are or are not that dedicated, that these people stops eating farmed salmon altogether.
Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to give us your feedback, rate, and review. We want to open up the salmon discussion to you.
Remember to keep in the fight for our salmon.